Okay, and I'll introduce Stephen Hall, who will be talking about ethical and stewardship considerations in aquaculture.
Great. Thank you, Dorothy. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for putting this session together, and hopefully I'm not too much of a down, but, you know, Dorothy gave you the really global picture. Tom gave you global over time picture, and now I'm going to take us down to the very practical level where we're actually trying to grow something, and we're looking at what both the implications of changes in water in the atmosphere and the reverse of that. How we grow things do either positively or negatively. So this is a particular case of aquaculture. I was at LSU until last year, and I went up to North Carolina State University, so I've been there less than 1 year, so almost my 1 year anniversary. And I am the director of the Marine Aquaculture Research Center at NC State. So I've had the opportunity to work with a variety of species, including some mammals up there in the upper right. As you'll see, I define aquaculture very broadly. So it is not just the fin fish, it also includes crustaceans, mollusks, reptiles, plants. So it's a pretty broad definition. I wanted to talk a little bit about simply the direction of, let's move into the food realm, and then in particular into the protein food realm. And so here we have the trends, things like beef that are actually going down on a global scale or steady to down, sheep and goats in a similar sense. The more efficient meats are rising, both because of demand, so poultry and pork are rising, but probably the most dramatic one in terms of percentage increase is farmed fish. So this is a trend that's occurring. And then to put that in context, where did our fish used to come from? They used to come from wild capture fisheries. And they used to be quite significant, 20 million metric tons per year in 1950 worldwide. That has gone up to about 80 million, so it's gone up quite a bit, but not an order of magnitude. It's still, you know, same sort of ballpark. And then it kind of hit a limit here, and it's been limited for 30, 40 years. And, you know, Dorothy mentioned it, and others have mentioned some of our marine fisheries are basically overfished. Some of them are in very significant trouble. Some of them are at sort of their limit. There's a few fisheries in the world that actually are moderately healthy, but they are the minority. The majority are at or really beyond their sustainable fishing capabilities. So what has happened is that people still like fish, and so aquaculture has grown to fill that niche. And depending on who you talk to and what stats you do, around 2012, aquaculture passed wild-caught fisheries for the seafood production. And that trend will continue. So over the foreseeable future, it is highly unlikely we will increase wild capture, and we may decrease slightly over time to allow those fisheries to recover. Or if we further impact the oceans, that number may go down all by itself, even though we are trying to do that. I have already been in touch with people who are dealing with economically extinct fisheries. So I take my boat out, I have my staff, I've got my diesel, I go out, I run trying to get my shrimp for a couple of days, I burn $1,000 worth of gas, I gotta pay my guys a couple $1,000s, I bring in the shrimp, I sell them, and I only get $1,000 back. That's economic extinction. I caught some fish. It's just not worth it to do it. So there are a lot of fisheries now that are at or near economic extinction, even though there are shrimp in the ocean. And so I think we're going to see that trend. Aquaculture, on the other hand, is likely to expand. Again, these are sort of trends that are happening, maybe not quite at the level that global climate change is happening and you can't stop it anytime in the near future, but a similar sort of trend. This is going to happen So for me, it becomes a question of how do you do that effectively, efficiently, ethically. So the first kind of attempt here is just to sort of lay out again broadly what is aquaculture. I said versus terraculture. So traditional agriculture mostly has been done on land. There has been a modest amount of aquaculture historically, but since about 1970 or 80, there has been this dramatic increase in aquaculture. And if you look at the planet, we've been looking at this planet a lot. What's the favorite color on that planet? Yeah, a lot of blue. So there's some white too, yeah, right? So that certainly is a space that potentially is available, whereas much of the land area we have exploited probably to near the limits or perhaps, again, beyond the limits that are responsible. You could get a little more subtle and say, really, you're probably not going to grow much way out in the middle of the ocean. Most of it will be in the coastal areas, but that is still a very large area to either impact negatively. I think it was Dorothy that put up a nitrogen and phosphorus eutrophication figure of the Gulf of Mexico. In Louisiana, we were friends and our kids played with the children of the people that were studying that. So that's a very real issue. So we want to do this again well. We do not want to do this in such a way that we further pollute our coastal waters. But aquaculture is really simply raising whatever it is, animals, plants, I even put bacteria on here, in water. It can be fresh water, it can be estuary, and it can be ocean water. You can include micro or macro algae and a variety of other species. So this is very, very broad. It could be essentially on land in ponds or tanks, or can be coastal, or can be, in theory, in the deep ocean, although there's not a lot that's very far offshore at this point. And then where does it happen? The vast majority actually is in Asia. China is the number one player. The U.S., this is sort of the relative area, is a player with about 1% of worldwide aquaculture production. But we have significant coastal resources and could do potentially more. Economics doesn't sort of tell us to do that. Right now we grow about $1 to $2 billion worth of our own seafood through aquaculture in the U.S. But we import about $20 billion, so we've got a pretty significant deficit in that sense. Part of that is that our farmers are producing with labor that's a little more expensive than Vietnamese labor, and so we import a significant amount of generally frozen or processed seafood from, and again, largely from Asia, some from Chile, and I'll get to talking about that. The Chileans have cold water resources. They're growing largely salmonids. Those are carnivorous fish, and so we'll come back to talk about that, but that is what the U.S. consumer demands and will pay for. So there, you can already see the beginnings of a sort of rich versus poor ethical issue. So I, again, like Tom, sort of, here's my laundry list of things that we might talk about. Rich versus poor, and I put sort of tilapia, but it could be catfish and it could be carp. It could be these sort of low trophic level, tough sort of fish, but these are the fish that already most of the poor countries grow these. They're good fish. There's nothing wrong with them. They're high protein. And they live low on the food chain. They're pretty efficient. Versus something like the carnivorous, and that would be maybe the salmonids. I'm going to talk about sturgeon here in a little bit. It's even more outrageous when you look at the dollars. That will not feed the world. You are not going to feed the world on sturgeon or even on salmon. But that is part of aquaculture. So you can't sort of have one without the other. I don't completely reject salmon. I just simply say, are there ways we can do that better? And then we've got sort of the environmental ethics, creation care approach, and in particular, I'm going to talk about water, but I'll also mention energy and other resources that then tie back again to the economics. I'll briefly talk about human and animal health. I see Jay Holman in the audience, and I'm sure Jay would have more to say about that, but that's also important. Fish are now both very healthy and also slightly dangerous, okay, depending on which fish you get from where and how. And there's a lot of subtlety. Unfortunately, at the public relations level, there's not much subtlety. Either you think farm fish are bad or you think farm fish are good, but there's no sort of middle ground where you say, how were they farmed? Where were they farmed? Were they in a pond that had controlled conditions so you wouldn't have things like mercury? Were they grown in impoundments that were perhaps in the ocean, where certainly some of the carnivorous fish would be accruing things like mercury, which could be significant? You'll read on the package, pregnant women should not eat more than one of these per day or per month or something like that. So human health is certainly an issue. And then I'm going to briefly talk about genetic issues. In an earlier talk, mentioned our reduction of bioresources worldwide. Again, we do not want this to be the sort of thing that reduces, but again, I'm going to reverse it. There was talk earlier about a zero energy house. Why not a house that produces energy? And a zero pollution aquaculture would be amazing. But what about aquaculture that actually cleans up the water? Is that possible? So I'm going to talk about that. And here are some of my favorite verses. So Genesis 1:26, the dominion verse. Adam should have dominion over. And the interesting thing is the first one is, read your Bible, over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the air and the beasts. Genesis 2:15, the Lord God put the man in the garden to shmar and abad the garden. And we've got a former Al-Sabah director up there who can tell us what shmar and abad is. I'll take a cut at it. I'm going to say something like protect and serve. And that word serve certainly is tied in English to conservation. And if you read that, it sometimes comes through as to till and keep. But that keep also is clearly a care for, steward sort of concept. In the New Testament, Jesus talks about the least of these. And by the way, that passage is a lot tougher than it looks. That's the sheep and the goats. And I sometimes wonder if I'm one of the goats. But anyways, this idea that we are called to serve the least of these. And who are the least of these? And that's a really hard question. Definitely the poor that have been referred to in previous talks. Also perhaps the young. And then future generations. And those are perhaps the poorest of the poor because they can't even put up a fight in Cochabamba or wherever else. Okay, so, but how do we do that? How do we take care of that? And then we have a vision of the future. Revelation 22 talks about the river of the water of life. This is in a city setting, which is very interesting. So it is a city, but it is an ecologically beautiful city. And that water waters the trees that produce their fruit in every season. And the leaves of the trees are for the healing of the nations. So there's some beautiful images in the Bible and some fairly compelling descriptions of what we perhaps should be doing. So that will be some of the basis as I work through some of these questions. So I'm going to speak briefly to feed conversion ratios. This is simply the pounds of feed that you put into the tank and how many pounds of fish do you get out. And so in theory, you can't get more than 1:1. So beef, depending on how they're raised, 6 to 20, I've seen numbers higher than that. Modern pork is very efficient, about 3 to 4. So you put 3 or 4 pounds of feed in and you get a pound of pork out. Pretty good. Chickens, even better, 2 to 3 pounds in the modern industry. Fish, routinely, are in the 1 to 2 range. And actually, you can get numbers below 1. Now, that's a little tricky, so how do you do that? Well, a little bit of it is fish are partly water. So that's a little bit of it. But that's not the whole answer. You're still getting protein out of fish. How do you do this if you have a multi-step aquaculture system, multi-trophic system? You can grow fish in the first step, and then the waste from the fish, which is nitrogen and phosphorus and other things, can go into a second step where you grow perhaps algae. Maybe you harvest that algae for something like biofuel, or maybe you use that to feed something like oysters, which are filter feeders and eat algae. And I've had students doing this for the last several years, so this can be done. You then get another product. You got a pound of fish over here. Now you're getting another pound of oysters. So I put 1 pound of feed in, and I got 2 pounds of seafood out. So you can. So that's a 0.5 in that case. So you can get incredible, literally incredible feed conversion ratios. So that can be done. So sort of this thought of how do you do things efficiently. Unfortunately, we tend to desire these high trophic level animals like salmonids. And I like salmon, I admit it. We don't eat it maybe as much as we might otherwise, but we do eat a little bit of it. Unfortunately, where does the feed for carnivorous salmon come from? Other fish, yes. So it is fish meal that comes from fish byproducts, that comes from the overfished oceans. Oh, darn, that might not be sustainable. So sturgeon or caviar, I'm going to give you a few numbers here just to dismiss this, but I do work with sturgeon. So public service announcement, yes, I work with sturgeon. You can skewer me afterwards. Sturgeon is not $2 a pound. It's not $20 a pound. It's not even $200 a pound. Sturgeon caviar is $200 per ounce. It's also a very long-lived species, a very slow-growing species, 6 to 8 years to sexual maturity. So you culture these things quite differently from something that you would do in a six-month or 1 year, even a two-year period. So I'm going to kind of dismiss that while acknowledging, yes, there are a limited number of rich who do these. If we're going to feed the world, it's got to be on that low trophic level. We have to do efficient production. Things like tilapia, catfish, and carp can be useful for the least of these. So here are some of my current people and maybe future people. So here is my oldest grad student with my youngest child. Here's the newest, she's a new PhD student at Princeton with my youngest child. Here is my most recent PhD graduate with my youngest child. So she favors in there, there's Joy. Charles, Hannah, Daniel. But then I also wanted to acknowledge people from around the world, some of whom come to the U.S. and we become friends with them. Young people that are learning in our situations. And then people around the world that are growing various species, for example, catfish. This is how we're going to feed the world. And we are attempting in our limited capacity to come up with systems that are more efficient and that can increase, or let's say decrease, these feed conversion ratios and improve the environment. So recirculating aquaculture systems sometimes have very high densities, but basically you can maintain that water quality. This is actually inside of a building. This is tilapia being grown in North Carolina in a steel frame building. Now the problem with these systems is they are, they're amazingly water efficient. Some of them are actually very, very close to 100% water efficient. A lot of them are better than 90%. But they have high capital costs and potentially high energy costs. There are ways to reduce some of those costs, and we're working on that. So as aquacultural engineers, things like low head oxygen. Low head implies lifting the water less. Lifting water costs a lot of money, but if you lift it just a little bit, you can still get oxygen into it, and you can do it for a lot less energy. And then the idea of reusing water. So I was recently at a facility that was raising some on it. Okay, sorry. But at least they reuse their raceway water, re-aerating it at each successive step down the mountain with God's gravity and the lift of the water. Now, there's a limit to that water, but if you can reuse it, you're at least stretching the water. They reused it 18 times. There's actually a couple of different wetland cycles in there where they take some of the nitrogen out. That's the same as about a 94% recirc system. You are reusing that water that many times. So it's a way of producing more fish for the same water. It turns out that well-run aquaculture is actually as efficient or more efficient at use of water than many other forms of animal agriculture, and even more efficient than some forms of plant agriculture. So it's a fairly legitimate thing. And so then I even put this little hint on here, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. Maybe we can even improve the environment in some cases, or at least not impact it too much. And then that allows natural stocks to recover. I had an alligator up there. Maybe I'll get one up. I want to talk about oysters and alligators. So here we've got oysters. Oh, we're going to dismiss the, okay, go away. That's our sturgeon. This efficiency question, and here, aha, I got it. Phosphorus, nitrogen, and then I put carbon on there as well. So Dorothy had phosphorus and nitrogen. Tom had carbon. Okay, I got you guys covered. All right, we're going to deal with all of them. The ecosystem services question that came up earlier, and really that's tied to this idea of externalities. If we can dump our waste and not pay for that, then we are not really paying our fair share. So that is an externality that needs to be accounted for somehow. Okay, and more that's coming back to haunt us. There are certainly high-protein food that's coming out of this, high-value products. There's a recent product that is based on tilapia skin as a healing agent for skin. I don't know if anybody's seen that as a medical product. And seems to be quite positive. So that's the byproduct of tilapia that's now going to be more valuable than the meat. But okay. But this idea of ecological services. So if we can sequester some of the phosphorus and nitrogen in things like plants in aquaponic systems or in wetlands where they are needed, that could be good. And if we can sequester carbon in, and I'm going to say oysters, but I will note that that's really the algae oyster complex. The algae is sequestering the carbon initially, and then it's getting stored fairly long term. Depending on what you do with these shells, that could be a very long term. I did a calculation back of the envelope. Can you have oyster reefs that will sequester carbon? And you can plausibly, in the water area adjacent to Louisiana, sequester all the carbon that is produced in Louisiana, which is an oil-producing state. So it seems possible that this is at least a significant role that we can do. So these are sort of some of the key technology things, moving lower on the trophic levels, more plant-based feed, dealing with waste effectively and trying to value add there, and then looking at local and global advantages. I wanted to talk briefly about genetic modification, because that had been requested. This is John Buchanan. He was actually finishing his PhD when I arrived at LSU. They recently released this fish. It has been approved by the FDA. I'm not saying that that is right or wrong. Here's the FDA's comment. Highly unlikely to have impact on the environment. They use triploid females that are sterile. As safe as conventional food, Canada even approved it. I was kind of shocked when I found that out. It does grow much faster, no doubt about that. It has genes from the Chinook and from the pout, so sort of three fish, but mostly one fish. It's basically still a Atlantic salmon. But these are other questions that are coming. Most of the corn and much of the other plant materials that you consume, that we consume, is already genetically modified. This is one of the first of the, in the aquaculture field to have this. And I'm probably going to have to stop on this because we're running out of time, but I just wanted to acknowledge that we are doing this sort of work, have done it in Louisiana and have done it in North Carolina, and I'm happy to be doing it. I'm very thankful to be in this session. This was an attempt to talk about something very specific that could have global implications, and by extension, I'm going to say aquaculture is a part of agriculture. In the grand sense of the word, it's part of providing food, and it's also very important to use it wisely so that we don't make our water resources worse, but maybe we make them better. So I'll stop at that point, and I also wanted to just point out the many young people I've had a chance to work with. I'm very thankful for that and kind of the future that they represent. So I'll stop at that, and maybe a question or two. Good question. Aquaculture can be done in salt water as well as fresh water, so there are a lot of coastal areas where you wouldn't be able to drink that water, but you can do aquaculture. There are probably cases where people are using fresh water where that could be a conflict. I don't know that it has to be. I think that's one of those things where if you can be very efficient with the water, and some of that's setting priorities and being ethical, which is hard, but possible. Yes, sir.
Could you assess the limitations? As I understand it, the world supply of fossils, it has to be mined, and it's presently peaked, so it's probably going to go down from here. Seems to me that's going to have a big impact on rain that you need for your agriculture, but grain production itself. So isn't that going to limit our ability to feed the world?
Interesting question. So not enough of something and too much of something, and it's the same something. So then that really implies, should we find ways to capture, recapture, and reuse that phosphorus? And perhaps some of these biological methods may be useful there. There was a proposal that came through that I reviewed at a federal level recently that had to do with using algae to capture nutrients and then use that to concentrate the nutrients and reuse those nutrients in agriculture. So there are people thinking about that. Yeah. Jay?
Well, it's the algae overgrowth that causes the dead zones anyway. So the question that I've heard about salmon that are raised in aquaculture that are about 70% on plant-based diet and 30% carnivorous. Comment on that. And the second issue is, what is the barrier, particularly to saltwater, saltwater aquaculture in the States? Is it regulatory? Is it economic? Why are we doing more with that when we're growing shrimp?
Great questions. So let me tackle them hopefully in order. First question focused on salmon, more or less.
Is that true? There's some places that can get 70% plant.
Studies on salmon, and interestingly, one that you think of as even more carnivorous is alligators. There's a significant alligator industry in Louisiana, and they have done studies there where they've got to 70 or 80% plant-based diets. Those are typically soy, so it's still a high-protein diet, but it is more plant-based. So yes, you can push those systems, and in a cultured system, you can do that in a controlled way. So you can make things, you can push even the carnivores down a little bit on the trophic level. So yes, you can make them not quite vegetarian, but a little closer. So you can knock down maybe 2/3 of that fish meal consumption. So yes. And then the second question was more about marine aquaculture. So this would be saltwater or estuary. Those are very rich areas. They're also available in theory, but they're also fragile. I mean, the picture of the Gulf of Mexico and the dead zone sort of points out some of the dangers there. There's also very high energies in offshore when the big storms come through. You can have massive waves there, so you don't have as much control. There are people working on ocean systems, and more they're looking at basically nearly closed systems where they can actually recapture those nutrients, both for environmental but for cost purposes. I have a student who just proposed something which may not be built for a number of years, where you would have a multi-trophic system that is nearly closed. You would take the waste from a fin fish, feed it into an algae, feed it into a mollusk system, and then use those mollusks as part of the feed back, and or the algae as part of the feed back into the fin fish system, reducing your environmental impacts and at the same time increasing the efficiency of the system. So there's people working on those things. Like a number of the other talks, we better get going and do more of this. But I think people are becoming aware. I think there was a generation of aquaculture that was unfortunately very irresponsible early on, and maybe just didn't think. Now I think most people that are in the business or getting in the business are acknowledging the regulations. Now, the regulations in coastal areas they vary by state, and they're trickier than, I don't claim to be any kind of regulation guy, but I will acknowledge that that is a concern that the industry as a whole is dealing with, and each state's a little different. I'll give you just one example. Virginia opened up much of their coastal resources to leasing. You can't own it, but you can rent it, and they increased their oyster industry by several 100% over the course of a decade. And that seems to be good. Oysters are filter feeders. They actually tend to improve water quality for the most part. They remove carbon. They actually, when you eat them, you're actually eating some of the nitrogen as well, so you're sort of not doing too bad. North Carolina has done the opposite. They have only leased a very small percentage. They're being very careful, and the industry is still quite small. So some of that is almost on a local basis. So there are technical questions, but there are definitely the governmental. I actually think Virginia may have overleased. I'm a little nervous that they've, how far do you want to go? You still need some level of regulation. But yes, I think they are, at this point, for example, North Carolina is probably an underutilized resource that could be further utilized without significant damage. So it's a tricky game. Yeah. Ben, way in the back.
When you mention GMO fish, you know, generally people in developing world are very suspicious of GMO, especially from the developed countries. Just the language itself gets a little bit edgy. How would you pacify someone when you talk of GMO and just feeling that this is something that's safe? What would you say to them?
I don't know that there's a lot of demand for salmon in Nigeria. I've worked with Nigerians. They love catfish, and most of the catfish is not GMO. So some of it may be a little bit of a moot point. I think you also have to acknowledge that if people want to, they should be able to buy what they want. There is a labeling question with this. These are actually not required to be labeled as GMO, which is a little, I'm sort of like, no, give people information. They can still make their own decision, but let them know, you know, what this is. So that's a little bit fuzzy. I would advocate for information, but at the same time, I think the market will influence what gets grown. So if there's a lot of people demanding it, there may be more grown. And if people say, I don't really want it, then I think that market decreases and you'll see less of it. Yeah. Terry?
So what's happening in the either now or... what are the prospects for sort of a bringing together of aquaculture and the idea of vertical farm, you know, urban
aquaponics.
Fisheries? Yeah. Yep. So aquaponics is using fish, usually in tanks, and then taking the effluent from the fish and trickling them through usually trays of some kind and growing plants. Neat idea. Use up the waste, get a second product. However, it's trickier than it looks. I'll just say that from a culture point of view. It can be done, but it is it's trickier than it looks. So for years, I sort of avoided it. Oh, yeah, sure, that's interesting. Lately, I have embraced it and said, people are doing it. They're having issues doing it, but they're doing it. So we are in the process of developing some advice, but then also sort of a series of warnings that basically this is harder than it looks. Not a bad idea. And now we're talking about a thing called decoupled aquaponic systems, where you basically raise the fish, you have a third tank of some kind where you can process those wastes into something that is more appropriate for the plants, and you process them through the plants. Not a bad idea. Some places, there was rooftop gardens that were mentioned the other day. That's a possibility. There are some inner city growth. I think when you look at the big picture, that's a limited proportion, but I think that in some places that can be appropriate. And the idea in general of using waste to grow a second crop does make some sense.
I mean, the idea of also having the aquaculture, agriculture in the urban environment where...
As an educational tool, it's great. Yes. Yeah, wonderful as an educational tool. And moderate. Moderate as a production technique. Maybe one more and then we'll stop.
Okay. Talking about the low trophic levels on some agriculture farms, so considering areas where we are trying to feed the poor, for example, so we're in North Africa, and other areas where they're trying to bring in more of the aquaculture practice. The problem is, so you have fish at the shoreline that may be good, but if there's no transportation grid to bring it safely before it totally spoils, then you haven't really accomplished much, except in the coastal regions, which now you're also trying to deurbanizing now and move back because the sea level is rising. So I'm not quite sure if we're staying hopeful or pretending to be hopeful while doom is coming, or is it doom is really coming?
Right, so I mean, now we've gone both ways. Yeah. Should we be doing it in the ocean, marine aquaculture? Maybe some. That has its own challenges, but there's space to do that. Should we be doing more inland, more recirculating type aquaculture? And there's actually a fair amount of that already happening in ponds and tanks where you do the production inland where there are people. Should we be doing something that's sort of adaptive as changes occur? And perhaps all three of those will occur over time. So I guess I'm cautiously optimistic. There are challenges with all of them, but they are all possible. And some of that is being done in each of those places already. we're basically just trying to do it more sustainably and more productively. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, let's say thank you.